Chapter 8. It was a black night for the squadron when the Ariel slipped her moorings and stood out into the rain-swept midnight sea, for she carried with her most of the wardroom's wine and an uneasy proportion of the foremast jack's rum and tobacco, as well as 20 prime hands chosen from among the many Dutchmen, Poles, Finns, and Letts in the fleet. She left something near prostration behind her, with little to enliven or revive it. In all his experience of naval life, Stephen Maturin had never seen anything to equal the speed with which the Ariel was equipped. Boats crowded about her, stores flowing in under the immediate supervision of Sir James. The Admiral contributed 3 tierces of a noble claret to the cargo, observing that he should willingly drink green tea for the rest of the commission rather than jeopardize Ariel's chances. And after that, no wardroom could do less. She stood out, therefore, deeper in the water than she had stood in, more crowded than ever, with barrels still lashed provisionally here and there on deck, the purser and the mate of the hold out of their wits, and more than half of her crew suspiciously jolly, if not downright drunk.
"There will be a long defaulters list tomorrow," said Jack, in a tone that sensibly reduced the merriment.
He had just emerged from a long session with Mr. Pellworm and the master, in which they had each independently laid down a course to intercept the licensed Dane they had passed not long before, the creeping, short-handed cat. 3 courses that coincided almost exactly, courses designed to find the cat in the first hours of full day.
"Mr. Fenton, we must have very good men at the wheel, and they must steer north 17 east exactly. Wittgenstein, the quartermaster from the flagship, will do for 1. An excellent seaman. I have sailed with him before. He will heave the log at every glass, keeping as near as possible to 6 knots, making or reducing sail accordingly. Above all, do not exceed. We must not pass in the darkness. And although I do not expect to see her before dawn, you will keep sharp, sober men at the masthead, changing them every glass. The lookout that first sights the cat shall have 10 guineas and remission of sins, short of mutiny, sodomy, or damaging the paintwork. I am to be called should anything occur, and should there be any change of wind."
In his earlier ships, he would have gone on to say that he was about to sup with the doctor on a very strange dish, a salted buzzard produced by the commandant at Gothenburg, and they would probably have talked about tomorrow's prospects for a while. But this was a temporary command. He hardly knew his officers, and in any case they seemed so young as almost to belong to another species. Their deference was burdensome, and it would require a real effort on his part, even at a social gathering, to cross the gap, as far as it could be crossed at all. But the godlike remoteness of command came naturally to him now, and having desired Fenton to repeat his orders and to place the written copy in the binnacle drawer, he went directly below. He found the buzzard already in pieces, carved not with the Christian carving knife and fork the steward had laid out, but with an instrument that Stephen hid under his napkin, as he said, "Forgive me, Jack. I have not actually begun, but I could not wait to see the creature's sternum. I learned a great deal about sternums in Paris."
"I am glad of that," said Jack, "and I am glad to see you are recovered."
"It was only a passing indisposition, caused perhaps by overindulgence in fish. In any event, the emotion of setting all in train has quite done away with it."
Jack had a notion that the easier motion of the ship might also have helped. The gale had blown itself out, and she was now slipping along with a quartering breeze, little roll and an even pitch, but he kept it to himself.
"Will you look upon this breastbone now, and at these sutures upon it?" said Stephen, holding up the buzzard's keel. "You would say they were attachments for the sternal muscles, would you not?"
"I should have taken my oath upon it, I do assure you."
"So should I, until a few days ago. But in fact it appears that they are the points of union of the bones that make up the sternum in the fowl's earliest youth. It was an eminent academician who told me this, a man whose acquaintance I prize extremely. He envisages a whole new classification."
Jack's attention wandered to the Ariel's topgallant masts, struck down on deck in the recent blow, until Stephen said with unusual emphasis,
"And those that put too much trust in a bird's toes as a generical symptom may find themselves compelled to call the nightjar and the osprey cousins."
"That would never do, I am sure," said Jack. It eats rather like pig, don't it?
Very like pig. But when you consider that the honey buzzard's diet consists mainly in wasps and their brood, it is scarcely surprising. Allow me.
He took the bones from Jack's plate and wrapped them in his handkerchief.
I was much impressed by your admiral, he said. Admirable admiral, admirable force of decision. I had been so afraid of interminable shilly-shally and reluctance to come to the hard point of assuming responsibility.
There is nothing like that about Sir James, said Jack. You remember him at Gibraltar, tearing out after the combined squadron? No shilly-shally there, I believe. But, Stephen, did you not remark how terribly he has aged? He cannot be 60 yet, but he looks an old, old man.
The appreciation of age is so relative. I dare say you look like a patriarch to the young men in the gunroom. I know that one of the midshipmen helped me across the street in Gothenburg, as though I were his grandsire.
I dare say I do, said Jack, laughing. I am quite certain they look terribly young, pitifully young to me. I hope to God they've had time to learn their profession. Are you away, Stephen?
I am. I mean to turn in, digest my buzzard in my cot, and sleep upon both ears for what is left of our time. Good night to you now.
Stephen was perfectly calm, in rather higher spirits than usual, and Jack had no doubt that he would sleep until the morning. He envied him. Although long training usually allowed him to drop off at any moment, Jack knew that tonight he would have little rest. He was extremely anxious, both reasonably and unreasonably anxious. He called for a pot of coffee, and as he drank it, he checked his course again. The answer came out the same as before, but there were so many, many things that could go wrong. So many variables. One of the variables would have been absent if he had had time to pick his own officers, men like Pullings and Babington and Mowat, who had sailed with him for years, and whom he knew through and through, or any of the better midshipmen he had formed and who were now lieutenants. But of course these young fellows in the Ariel's gunroom must know their profession. Young though they might be, they had all served afloat since their childhood, and the ship was in excellent order. Sir James had remarked upon it.
He had rarely seen a sloop of war in such good order.
Hyde might be no 9 days' wonder, no great seaman, but he was an adequate first lieutenant, a good disciplinarian, firm but no bully, while the master was an excellent navigator without any kind of doubt. And Fenton seemed above the average run of amiable, competent lieutenants, a man who might do very well if ever he had the good luck to be promoted. He dismissed that part of his anxiety as nonsense, and 10 minutes later he was on deck to see whether they knew what they were about. The rain had stopped, the sky was clearing, no moon, pitch dark. The ship was steering true, and a glance at the log-board showed that she had kept to a steady 6 knots. She was under topsails, with a single reef and an easy sheet. Fenton certainly knew how to sail her, although it was close on 3 bells in the graveyard watch, and although there was no duty in hand, the deck was unusually alive. The odd sheltered places forward or under the lee of the boats sheltered no sleeping figures, their heads wrapped in their jackets. All hands who were not high aloft were at the rails, staring out into the night. One of these was Wittgenstein, a Heligolander brought up in the Leith coal trade. As a midshipman, Jack had pressed him out of his collier, and they had sailed together in 3 or 4 commissions to their mutual liking. In the second of these, when Jack's navigation was still not all that it should have been, Wittgenstein was one of the prize crew with which Jack had to take a valuable merchantman into Port of Spain. And thanks to Wittgenstein alone, they had not only survived 2 very nasty blows that carried them a great way out of their course, but found their way, 3 weeks overdue, to Trinidad. He came aft to trim a stern lantern, and Jack said,
"Well, Wittgenstein, I'm glad to see you again. It must be 7 or 8 years since we were shipmates. How do you come along?"
"Pretty spry, sir, thank God, though we are none of us as young as we was, and I see you are pretty spry too, sir,"
said Wittgenstein, looking at him keenly in the yellow glow.
"Well, fairly spry, all things considered."
Jack stayed on deck for a couple of glasses, and after that he appeared again from time to time to watch the steady working of the ship and gaze at the star-sprinkled sky. Mars was setting, tangled in Virgo, somewhere over Lithuania. Jupiter shone glorious astern. The night seemed never-ending, a continual easy glide through darkness. Yet he was asleep, sitting in the ingenious swinging chair that Draper had slung in the great cabin, when a midshipman came to tell him that a sail had been sighted. He had slept through the changing of the watch, and now as he came on deck the first streaks of dawn were showing. The binnacle lights still gleamed, and at first he could make out nothing but the line of the horizon.
"Just forward of the shifting backstay, sir," said the master who had the morning watch.
He caught the lifting fleck of white, trained his night glass on it, and stared long and hard. No, it would not do. This was not his cat. It was too early for his cat. And in any case, the sail to leeward was steering south. Yet on the other hand, a train of possibilities raced through his mind as he automatically slung his glass and climbed into the maintop, a serious and rather stern expression on his face. He knew from the Admiral that there were no British cruisers on this station apart from the brig Rattler, and this was a three-masted vessel. Then again, it was unlikely that any English merchantman should be sailing alone. They nearly all waited for convoy to protect them from the Danish privateers. The master followed him. The light was growing fast. The distant ship, for a ship she was, though small, hung there, an inverted image in his night-glass, somewhat dreamlike.
"She is no cat, neither," he observed, passing the telescope. "What do you make of her, Mr. Grimmond?"
"No cat, sir, I agree," said Grimmond, after a long searching pause. "I can see her t'gallant yards as plain as plain. I should not like to take my oath on it, but she looks rather like the Minnie, a Dane out of Aarhus. We saw her often last year, and chased her twice. She has a fine turn of speed on a bowline, and she lies very close indeed."
"Let us go up to the masthead, Mr. Grimmond,"
said Jack, calling to the lookout to slide down the stay. There was barely room at the main cross-trees of so small a ship as the Ariel for a 16-stone post captain and a stoutly built master, and the frail spars creaked ominously. Grimmond was horribly embarrassed as well as frightened. Ordinarily two such figures would have clung close together, but he could not bring himself to such familiarity with the person of Captain Aubrey, and he was obliged to adopt an odd, crucified posture between a shroud and a backstay. The first thing that Jack did was to search for his quarry, the cat heading for Riga. At this height he commanded a disk of sea 25 miles in diameter. There was no cat in it. Nor should there have been any cat. By all his calculations, she should still be over the southeastern horizon, crawling towards a point in the sea where the Ariel should cut her course at about the beginning of the forenoon watch.
"Yes, sir," said the master. "I'm almost sure she is the Minnie now. Her topsides are all black, and she carries a boat on stern davits."
"And what may she be?"
"Why, sir, sometimes she's a trader, sailing under our licence, or dealing with the French on her own account. And sometimes she is most likely a privateer. Maybe both together when the opportunity offers. She certainly had no licence when she ran from us, beating into Danzig."
"She is fast, you say?"
"Very fast on a wind, sir. But going large, the Ariel has the legs of her. We should have caught her the second time, but that she ducked in under the guns of Bornholm. We were coming up hand over fist."
"What does she carry?"
14 Danish six-pounders, sir."
A considerable armament for a merchantman, but even so no match for the Ariel. Jack considered, hanging there between the clear sky and the deck. The cat was hypothetical. Likely, but still hypothetical. She was desperately slow, and sailing or towing her down the Baltic would eat up a great deal of time. The Minnie was no sort of a hypothesis. She was there, plainly to be seen. She was fast. She was heading in the right direction. A chase would take him on his way, and she was under his lee.
"Very well, Mr. Grimmond," he said. "We will see if we can catch her this time."
And reaching out for a backstay, he slid down on deck in one long, smooth sweep. Apart from the very beginning, when he was fairly sure he could rely on the Minnie's lookout to ignore the Ariel for a while, in the usual merchantman fashion, and then upon a demi-privateer's curiosity and eagerness for prey, he knew that there would be little room for guile in this pursuit. It would be a straightforward race, a match of speed, perhaps of seamanship, and there was all day to run it in, a fair wind and an open sea. He bitterly regretted his t'gallant masts, struck down on deck during yesterday's hard blow and never swayed up since. He had meant to leave it until both watches should be on deck. There would be no room for guile in the long run, but still it would be foolish not to take whatever advantage there was to be gained. They were nearly 5 miles apart, scarcely hull up from the deck, and it would take a long while to make up that distance, particularly as the Minnie already had her topgallant yards crossed, and the Ariel was rather deep-laden. He sent her slanting casually across the sea to cross the Minnie's wake, still under topsails, suspended the ritual of washing the deck, stated that hammocks would not be piped up until further notice, ordered hammock cloths to be draped over the gun ports and topgallant masts and yards laid along, ready to be swayed up and crossed at a moment's notice, with royals to follow them, and desired the officers to follow his example in changing their fine blue coats for pea jackets. He had gone to sea with only one uniform, his best, and the Ariel's gunroom, supposing this to be his own choice, his normal standard of dress, had hitherto presented an appearance that would have done credit to a flagship, with blazing buttons, epaulettes, and eminent hats, visible a great way off, certain marks of a king's ship. He also sent most of the hands below, keeping only about a dozen in view. The Minnie sighted them earlier than Jack had expected. From the main top he saw her people running about, a surprisingly heavy crew, and an almost conclusive proof of her being a privateer. Quite enough men to serve her 7 guns of a side, or to board and carry any ordinary Baltic merchantman. She rounded to for a closer look, and Jack called,
"Danish colours, Mr. Grimmond!"
The Minnie seemed pleased, and answered with the same, coming a little nearer.
"Steer to close her, Mr. Grimmond,"
said Jack in the waiting silence. But even as he spoke, the Minnie smelt a rat, turned on her heel, dropped her topgansels, and fled southeast. Before the Ariel had loosed hers, the chase already had her royals abroad, and the distance was growing rapidly. The delay irked Jack extremely. He could blame nobody but himself, and he urged the royal masts and yards aloft with a grim urgency that filled all hands with concern. Yet in time, masts, yards, and a spider's web of stays were where they should be. All sail the ship could bear was set, and drawing drum tight, all falls were coiled down and cleared away, and the Ariel, under her own colours and with her pennants streaming forward high over all, bore away in the Minnie's wake, gradually reaching the utmost speed that the fair breeze on her starboard quarter would allow. It was too soon to tell which was the happier on this point of sailing, but Jack was reasonably certain that he should overhaul the chase before the end of the day. There were few faster sloops in the service than Ariel, and he knew her pretty well by now.
"Very well, Mr. Hyde," he said. "I believe we may remove the hammock cloths and carry on with cleaning the decks."
The interrupted ship's day resumed its natural course. Sand and holystone scoured the worn white wood. Hammocks were piped up and stowed. The galley chimney started to smoke. Hands were piped to breakfast. And all this time the two ships raced over the morning sea. When Stephen came on deck, eager for his coffee, surprised and somewhat aggrieved at not even having smelt it yet, he was led, by a gentle midshipman, to the bows, where the captain and the master were training their sextants on the chase.
"Good morning to you, Doctor," said Jack. "I hope you have slept well."
"Admirably well, I thank you, and am as a giant refreshed. My eyes are keen, my appetite and all my senses remarkably acute. Indeed, I perceive a sail a great way off, there, directly beyond the prow. But perhaps you have noticed it."
"Mr. Grimmond was good enough to point it out in the morning watch. She is your merchantman, though rather a queer one, and I'm happy to tell you we are gaining on her at last. She went away very quick to begin with."
"So that is why you are sailing so fast, with such a quantity of sails."
"Many a stitch saves time," said Jack, "but I doubt we hold on to our royals much longer."
"The speed is quite exhilarating," said Stephen. "Do not you find the speed lift your heart, Mr. Grimmond? See how the grey billow rises. We part it. White foam flies down our side. The brave boat, she would cut a slender oat straw with the excellence of her going. I could watch it forever, although breakfast is going cold in the cabin. I say, although my coffee grows chill, Captain Aubrey."
"I am with you this minute," cried Jack.
And so he was, for the space of a dish of burgoo and half a dozen fried eggs with a due proportion of bacon, toast and marmalade, Gothenburg and Karlskrona having done them so proud. But he carried his last cup of coffee on deck. He had chased for a fortune before now, but he had not chased with so great an urgency in his heart. From a merely personal point of view, he had undertaken to do a very difficult thing, and he must bring it off. But very much more than that, he fully understood the importance of the task in hand, the capital importance of Grimsholm. Nothing would prevent Stephen from making the attempt, nor should it. Jack had the greatest confidence in his powers, yet Stephen's danger must be far less if he were set down on the island before the French officers arrived, perhaps to reverse the whole situation. The Frenchmen had reached Hollenstein on Tuesday, and if they took passage in such a flyer as the Minnie, they might be in Grimsholm very, very soon indeed. It was in fact by no means impossible that they would aboard her this minute. Her course would agree perfectly with such a voyage. His officers, or most of them, were competent, but they had nothing like his experience in driving a ship, in getting the last ounce of thrust out of the breeze, and as the morning wore on, this proved a tricky breeze into the bargain, sometimes coming in gusts strong enough to endanger her topgallants, if not the upper masts themselves. A tricky opponent, too. The Minnie, put to her shifts, tried every change of helm to probe the aerial's best point of sailing, every combination of sails. Jack responded to all of these, and to every variation in the wind. Stunsails flashed out aboard the sloop, stunsails aloft and alow on either side as occasion served, bonnets, drablers, and just before they parted, so they were taken in. There was an atmosphere of pleasurable tension and excitement in the aerial. The hands jumped to their work. They plied the hoses in the tops, wetting the sails for a slightly greater thrust with a jet that reached the yard, and they whipped buckets up to the crosstrees to soak the topgallants with a splendid zeal, and as often as not they were ready at the sheets or halyards with an intelligent anticipation before the order was given. The gain was slight, sometimes no more than a cable's length in an hour, but it was certain. The chase had been hull up since the middle of the forenoon watch. By the time of the noonday observation, the Minnie had proved to her own satisfaction that she lost least by putting directly before the wind, and so she sailed, under a noble pyramid of canvas, starting her water over the side and tossing her guns after it, 14 splashes that lightened her by as many tons. "Shall you come to dinner?" asked Stephen 2 hours later. "The steward is in a great taking, and declares the sucking pig will be spoilt."
"No," said Jack. "Do you see his save-alls? The damn thing about chasing in the Baltic is that they nearly always have better gear, best Riga sailcloth, and such hemp for their cordage, and they can crack on when we dare not. That Dane needs watching. I shall take a bite on deck. A damn good seaman."
"Will he succeed in running clear, do you suppose?"
"I hope not, I'm sure. At the present rate of sailing, and if nothing carries away, we should be up with her a little after sunset. But this is a cross-grained breeze, and the more it slackens, the less we gain. The Minnie is going very well, and I believe she would be happiest in very light airs. She swims high, you see, and I'm pretty sure she's been new-coppered. All the officers agree that she has never shown such a turn of speed. She would be the very thing for the Admiral. He is in great need of avisos."
"You are confident of taking her, I find."
"Oh, I should never say anything as unlucky as that. I should never count the bear's skin before it is hatched. Oh, no. I only mean that were she taken, she might be brought into the service. There is a fair chance, a very fair chance. But above all, I hope to come up with her before night sets in. This is the dark of the moon, and there will be precious little starshine."
The long, long afternoon, and still they ran. In spite of their increased numbers, the aerial's crew were growing jaded with the incessant shifting of the upper sails and the pumping. But it was just as bad, or even worse, aboard the Chase, reflected Jack, and in any case he had now settled upon the best trim. Naked mizzen, both main sheets aft, for topmast scandalized, forecourse in the brails, all the fore stunsails setting beautifully and the bowsprit fully clothed. And now the hands should have a rest. What he really feared was the rising glass and the falling of the wind, which would certainly favour the lighter Minnie. Not that in his deepest, least avowed conviction he had any doubt of overhauling her sooner or later, even after a gust had blown the main royal out of its bolt rope. But sooner was so infinitely important, he reflected, looking angrily at the Minnie's unyielding canvas as his own flimsy, worn-out Admiralty No. 8 raced aloft to replace the streaming sail. The true cold fear, the doubt of total failure, did not come to him until much later, when the setting sun began to swallow the breeze and the Minnie drew perceptibly ahead. She had been within very long gunshot this last hour, and he had cleared away the bow chasers long since, but at no time had he been willing to maul a ship that he would have to use, and now there was a likelihood that gunfire would stun the remaining wind. Yet it might be the right solution, for if the Minnie gained like this, and if the breeze kept light and true, she might waft into Grimsholm before him, and the island was directly in her path, and by now it was no great way off. A night's sail, perhaps. Having ordered the perilous expedient of a skysail on the main, perilous because the Ariel's royal mast had been sprung when the sail blew out, he turned the question over in his mind. The little quarter-deck was crowded, all the officers and young gentlemen having been there with scarcely a break since the beginning of the chase, but if they spoke at all, it was in low voices. Now they were all silent, waiting for what would happen when the skysail was sheeted home. The only sound that reached Jack in his holy area of deck by the starboard rail was the conversation between Dr. Maturin and Jagiello. The significance of the skysail escaped them entirely, and they talked away with the freedom of perfect ignorance.
"Pray, Mr. Jagiello," said Stephen, "what is the coast we see? Would it be part of Courland, or perhaps of Pomerania, or am I much astray?"
"I am totally in the sea," said Jagiello, cheerfully. "It might be anywhere. All this part of the Baltic coast is much the same, flat with immense sand dunes for miles and miles, and shallow water. It is sterile, barren, no good to anybody, but Poles and Swedes and Russians and Germans have fought for it for hundreds of years. I can see a ruined castle with the telescope, but I cannot tell what it is." He passed the glass, adding, "The only thing it does produce is amber."
"Amber!" cried Stephen.
And at the same time a collective sigh rose from the professional part of the quarter-deck. The skysail held, and the scrap of canvas, for it was no more, gave the Ariel a slightly greater thrust, just enough to prevent the chase from gaining. This did not resolve Jack's problem, however, and he found himself wishing, with uncommon vehemence and a vexation of spirit rare in him, that the talk about amber, its origin, its electrical properties, its uses in classical antiquity, Thales of Miletus on amber, might stop.
"Mr. Hyde, let the water be—"
he began, his eyes fixed on the Minnie. But to his astonishment he saw her shift her helm, altering course to larboard until she had the breeze 3 points abaft the beam. He cut his sentence short and gave out a volley of orders. "Driver, mizzen topsail, t'gallant and royal forecourse for topsail, together with the crowd of stunsails and staysails that had been useless with the wind dead aft." And now the Ariel's strong crew of man-of-war's men showed to full advantage. This cloud of canvas broke out with astonishing rapidity. Sheets were tallied aft and belayed before the Minnie had spread more than half of hers. But even before this was done, even before Stephen and Jagiello had been tumbled about more than twice by racing groups of men, Jack had sent a midshipman to the masthead. The Minnie's change of course seemed mere suicide. Not only had she proved that the Ariel outpaced her sailing large like this, proved it much earlier in the day, but now she had lost a cable's length in the last few minutes. On such a course she must lose close on a mile in an hour, even with all the sail she possessed abroad, and the sun was still a hand's breadth from the horizon. The only explanation he could think of was that she had seen an ally inshore or an enemy in the offing.
"On deck there!" hailed the midshipman. "A sail, sir! A sail! 2 points on the starboard bow! Do you make out a pennant?" he called.
It was an idle question. If the Minnie had not seen the pennant, the mark of a man of war, she would never have sheered off, but he wanted confirmation of his joy.
"Oh, yes, sir, and I believe I know her. Hermaphrodite on the starboard tack. She's coming about." "Yes, sir, I recognise her for sure."
"What is she?"
"Humbug, sir,"
said the midshipman, in a rather hesitant roar. Jack could not believe he had heard aright.
"What did you say?"
he cried.
"Humbug, sir."
and from the bows came a peal of honest mirth, while within arm's reach of the captain, three young gentlemen writhed in an effort to contain themselves, and all the officers were on the grin. It was a current Baltic joke, but one that newcomers could not know. Just before the Russians joined the Allies, a facetious captain of the Royal Navy had captured one of their vessels, a very distinctive tyne-built hermaphrodite, a fine sailor on a bowline, and he had changed her impossible Russian name to this, the only humbug ever known or likely to be known in the Navy list. Humbug, by God! The word had been used to him, publicly, on his own quarterdeck. The boy must be drunk. For a moment Jack's face took on a most forbidding look, and the grins died away, but then his pomp, his righteous indignation, dissolved, and he said,
"Very well, Mr. Jevons. You will stay there till I call you."
He gazed at the Minnie. She was jammed in a clinch like Jackson.
"Let us take in the skysail, Mr. Hyde," he said. "There is no point in endangering the mast."
He was convinced that he could give the Minnie royals on this tack, and even the foot-to-gallant, and still lay her aboard within the hour. He would not have to use his bow-chasers.
"Yes, sir," said Mr. Hyde. "No, sir. No point at all. And by the way, sir, the hermaphrodite really is called Humbug. Jevons meant no disrespect."
"Is that so? Well, well, then he may come down again. Where is the signal midshipman? To Humbug, since that is her name, enemy in sight, chase to east-south-east and give her a gun. Mr. Jagiello, I am sorry they knocked you down. You are all right now, are you not?"
"Oh, perfectly well, sir," said Jagiello, laughing. "It was nothing at all. My spurs caught in the rope. I believe I shall take them off."
"I beg your pardon, sir," said Mr. Pellworm, "but she is heading for the Foughton Bank. Indeed, she is almost on the tail of the Kraken already, if I do not mistake."
"Is she, though?"
cried Jack. The Foughton was a series of shoals a few miles off the flat sandy shore, and its winding channel was very little frequented. The Minnie, riding light, would draw 2 feet less water than the Ariel. Her hope, her last hope, was to lead her pursuer over a bank where the Minnie would pass and the Ariel stick tight. That was one of the reasons for her sudden turn.
The Fox! Light along the lead there. Mr. Pellworm, can you carry us through?
I believe so, sir,
said Pellworm, glancing significantly at the vast spread of canvas overhead.
Then she is yours. Reduce sail as soon as you please.
The sun dipped. The pink sails came in one by one. The Ariel fetched them in his wake and glided along, no longer gaining, with the lead going on either side, and the pilot, grave and concentrated at the con, now fixing his sea marks, a tower on the shore, and a distant spire with his azimuth compass, now staring at the ship ahead to catch the least motion of her helm. It moved often as she pursued her dog-legged course, apparently quite at home. With a 15-minute interval, the Ariel's rudder made the same motion as she glided over the seemingly innocent sea in the twilight. It was a strange procession. All the flying speed and excitement was gone, replaced by quite a different tension. Her bower anchors were ready, a cockbill at the catheads, with a kedge at the stern davits and hands stationed to let them go at the word. There was silence, fore and aft, not a sound but the pilot's orders and the leadsman's chant.
"Border deep, six. By the deep, six. By the mark, five. And a half, five."
And so it went, until the leadsman's voice rose in a sharp emphasis,
"And a half, three. And a half, three."
To a man the Ariels pursed their lips. Precious little water under them now.
"Peck the foretopsail," called the pilot, taking the wheel. "And a half, three. By the mark, three. A quarter less, five. By the deep, six. And a half, six."
They were in the deep channel once more. Jack breathed out at last. Water under his keel, thank God. But the Minnie was turning again, turning 3 points to starboard. There was ugly stuff coming, for sure. He must not worry the pilot, but Lord, how he longed.
"She's struck!"
came a bellowing mooncalf roar from the bows.
"She's grounded herself, the bloody old fatherlasher! Haw-haw!"
A quartermaster choked him short. A midshipman beat him with a speaking trumpet. But what he said was true. The Minnie came gently to a halt in the sea. All her masts gave an easy lean forwards, and then a most furious lean as her captain dropped and sheeted home all his clewed-up sails in an attempt at driving her over the bank. A vain attempt, nor could he back her off. She was held fast, lying there on an even keel, as motionless as though she were moored head and stern. More so, since she did not even rock.
"Briskly with the lead there," cried Jack. "Can you lay her alongside, Mr. Pellworm?"
"Close on, sir," said the pilot, chuckling.
"But a mark seven," chanted the leadsman. "And a half seven."
"This is the Kraken Channel," observed Mr. Pellworm. "Stand by the kedge."
The Minnie was coming nearer, nearer and nearer. Her people's faces could be seen, white blobs in the twilight, their voices heard. They were launching a boat over the stern, a little gig. Jack saw uniformed figures on her deck, French officers without a doubt.
"That will do, Mr. Pellworm," he said, within a cable's length of the immobile chase.
He did not wish the boat to be masked by the ship for any length of time. He did not wish to come too close, spoiling his line of fire.
"Let go the kedge. Let go the best bower. Rail up. Clew up."
He took a speaking trumpet and hailed,
"Minnie, hoist in that boat, or I shall blow you out of the water."
No response, but a furious altercation and a pistol shot aboard the chase.
"Mr. Jagiello," he called, "pray hail them in Danish and repeat what I said. Mr. Hyde, a spring to the cable."
Jagiello shouted the message high and clear over the 200 yards of sea, shouted it in different languages. The boat splashed down into calm water. The French officers jumped into it, and at the same moment, as though by an afterthought, the Minnie struck her colours. The boat vanished along her starboard side.
"Quarters!"
said Jack, and in a moment the gun crews were at their stations. The guns themselves had been run out long ago.
"Mr. Hyde, three quarters on, then full."
The Ariel turned on her spring, then steadied, almost as firm as the Minnie. When the boat reappeared, crossing the Minnie's stem and pulling inexpertly for the land, it was directly in the starboard bow chaser's line of fire. Another turn of the capstan would bring the whole broadside to bear, and at point-blank range. From a steady platform, an unmoving ship, a crew far less skilled than the Ariel's could scarcely miss.
"Mr. Nuttall," he said to the gunner, "single round shot and pitch it beyond them."
The gunner laid his piece, fired. The ball struck 50 yards beyond the boat in a true line and went skipping across the sea in a series of enormous bounds. The boat rowed on.
"Again?"
said Jack. This time the smoke obscured the fall of the shot, but as it cleared, there was the boat still heading for the shore.
"Full on, Mr. Hyde," said Jack, in a harsh voice.
It was a sickening business, but his carronades would not reach much farther, and no single gun could be perfectly relied upon. He must get it over at once. The ship was broadside on, the gun crews poised about their carronades.
"From forward aft," he said, "deliberate fire. Wait for the smoke to clear. Fire one."
The first shot pitched a little wide. The second rocked the boat, and in the eddying smoke he saw a man stand up. Was he waving a handkerchief? In the split second of his thought, the third gun fired, striking the boat fair and square. Planks flew up, and something like an arm. A savage cheer all along the deck, and the gun crews turned their beaming faces, clapping one another on the back.
"How's your guns?" said Jack. "Cutters away. Mr. Fenton, see if there are any survivors. Mr. Hyde, take possession of the prize and make the master lighten her at once. Anderson will interpret for you. Mr. Grimmond, a light in the main top to guide the Humbug, and rouse out an 8-inch hawser. We must heave her off at once. There is not a minute to be lost."
Every minute was indeed irreplaceable, yet they flowed away by the score and by the hundred. The Minnie would not move. The channels were so narrow, the navigation so intricate, that a vessel of Ariel's draught could not move with any freedom, could not take up a proper station. With infinite labour they laid out anchors by means of the launch, dragging the heavy cables behind them, and every time the capstan turned, taking the full strain and transmitting it to the Minnie, the anchors came home again. The situation was already difficult by the time Fenton returned with the one survivor, a youth of about 17, wounded in the leg and head, unconscious. It was far more complicated some time later when Stephen came up from the sick bay. There were ropes leading in every direction, stretching out into the darkness. In the glow of the lantern, the faces of the men at the capstan bars looked worn and jaded, all excitement gone. Jack had just finished a roared series of instructions to some distant boat when Stephen appeared.
"How does he come along?"
he asked in a hoarse voice.
"I believe we may save him," said Stephen. "The ligature seems to hold, and the young are wonderfully resilient. You seem in a sad way, brother."
"Tolerably so, tolerably so. Her after bits gave way, and we've lost our small bower, parted at the ring. But it could be worse, and I dare say Humbug will be here presently. She don't draw more than a few feet."
He sounded cheerful, and in fact the incessant activity kept the surface of his mind from brooding on the prospect of the hours ahead. But at no great depth he was aware that dirty weather was brewing in the north, that the Humbug, creeping over the shoals from the other side, creeping over the far extremity 5 miles away, had missed the channel and had already grounded twice, and that if anything of a sea got up, he should be obliged to slip his cables and run, abandoning the Minnie and perhaps the whole enterprise so promising not long ago.
"Were you able to get anything out of him?"
"I was not," said Stephen. "He is in a deep coma. But I'm afraid his uniform has nothing of the aide-de-camp's glory about it at all, and his letters are those of an ordinary subaltern. Besides, such a wild dash was surely the act of boys, rather than of sober, reflecting senior officers."
"I don't know," said Jack. "If I had command of a place like Grimsholm, I think I might have tried it. I think I might have tried for a horse on shore. It is not many hours' ride. But I'm very certain that I should have pulled away on the blind side for a mile or two. What is it, Mr. Rowbottom?"
"If you please, sir, the spare anchor is new puddened."
"Very good, very good. Then bend the bitter end to it. The bitter end, Mr. Rowbottom."
"Oh, yes, sir, the bitter end it is."
The second lieutenant came for fresh instructions, and while the urgent technical talk flowed past his ears, Stephen watched the lights far over the bank, the lights of all aerials and Minnie's boats busy about the radiating arms of rope that were to pull her off. Of all the boats, except the gig, which was carrying Pellworm away to the distant Humbug, to bring her in through the devious channels. A small, dismal rain began to fall, veiling the lights. Fenton ran aft, and Stephen said,
"But if I may have a word with the Minnie's captain, we may learn all there is to be learned. I must speak to him in any event to hear what he has to say about Grimsholm. I understand that the Minnie goes there from time to time."
"As soon as we have a boat free, I will send for him,"
said Jack, and raising his voice he called,
"Mr. Hyde, tell the Minnie's master to stand by to come across in the next boat. He is to bring the ship's papers, too."
"Sir,"
came Hyde's reply out of the wet darkness,
"the Frenchman pistoled him. Shall I send his mate?"
2 dim, wet figures came to report. An unseen boat hailed to say that the warp was entangled in a sunken wreck.
"Never fret your spirit now, my dear," said Stephen. "It would advance us nothing at this stage to know whether General Mercier is living or dead. Tomorrow morning would answer very well, so it would."
A violent, rending sound, a confusion of voices in the darkness, and Jack disappeared. Stephen waited, and then, the rain increasing, he went down to his cot, where he lay staring at the candle flame in his lantern, his hands behind his head. Physically, he was tired, and his body relaxed throughout its entire length. His mind was in much the same state, floating free, detached, as though he had taken his old favourite, the tincture of laudanum. He felt no particular anxiety. The attempt must either succeed or fail. He hoped with all his heart for success, but all his heart did not amount to a great deal now that some essential part of its core seemed to have died. Yet on the other hand he felt more able to command success in that it meant no less to him, to command it with a strength that arose not indeed from a fundamental indifference to his own fate, but from something resembling it that he could not define. It had a resemblance to despair, but a despair long past, with the horror taken out of it. The Humbug came through the fairway late in the middle watch, having had to fetch a long cast to windward, beating up tack upon tack. She brought the growing breeze with her and the threat of a dirty end to the night. The lantern swung wider in the small, silent cabin. Stephen slept on. For the next hour and more the Hermaphrodite laid out anchors and buoys. The ablest seamen in all 3 vessels spliced cables end to end. The cables ran through the hawse holes until there were none left in the tiers, and gradually the whole series of purchases, designed either to pluck the Minnie from her bed or to tear her guts out, took form. Stephen woke to the sound of a familiar voice raised high, so high that it pierced the deck, for now the whole system was to be put to the test, and now the strain was on, a strain divided between four anchors, nearly a mile of cables and hawsers, and all concentrated on the aerial's capstan.
"Stamp and go!" cried Jack to the hands at the bars. "Stamp and go! Heave! Heave her round! Heave hearty there!"
By now most of the men were minnies pressed into the present service. Though they might not understand the actual words, the gist was plain enough. They could scarcely gain an inch as they heaved, and the brisk clicking of the pawls faded steadily to no more than a click a minute, and then to none. Now the full force was on. The cable between the two ships showed never a curve as it vanished into the faint but growing light.
"Heave and rally! Heave! Heave and rally! Bosun, start that man! Heave and pawl! Well, fare ye, my lads! Now heave with a will!"
A distant cry.
"She stirs!"
The bars moved. The gasping men advanced half a step. The capstan turned. Turned faster.
"Well, fare ye! Heave and away!" cried Jack.
The Minnie slid stern first from her bank, gliding into deep water where she lay rocking easy, and half a dozen hands collapsed at the bars. Stephen dozed off for a time, while innumerable ropes of all sizes were recovered and stowed away. He heard a last cry of,
"Splice the main brace!"
and sank far down into sleep. It was full day when he woke. The rain had stopped, and the Minnie was alongside, receiving the aerial's wine and tobacco. Far, far astern, the Humbug could be seen sweeping for the lost small bower. All hands, apart from the spry and cheerful Jagiello, looked somewhat bleary, but none so bleary as a glum, middle-aged man in a sheepskin cap with books under his arm, who was pointed out to Stephen as the Minnie's first mate.
"Mr. Jagiello," said Stephen, "I'm just about to visit my patient. When I come back, and I do not expect to be long, may I ask you to be so kind as to desire that man to come downstairs, to your cabin, if you please? With your help, I should like to ask him some questions."
The visit was indeed quite brief. The young man was still in his coma, looking little more than a child, in spite of his carefully trained, nascent moustache. He was breathing easily, deeply, and the surgery seemed successful so far. At least the delicate ligature had held, and would hold now. But Stephen had a keen sense of approaching death, and he believed he felt it now. There was nothing he could do at present, and he walked back to Jagiello and the mate. The questions were asked. Who were the French officers in the boat? What were the signals used for approaching Grimsholm? What were the formalities of landing? But little response did they obtain. The mate took refuge in ignorance and forgetfulness. This was his first voyage in the Minnie. He knew nothing of Grimsholm. He had never seen the Frenchmen. He did not remember anything about them.
"I think I shall leave this sullen fellow for a while," said Stephen, looking at the Minnie's muster roll. "A period of recollection may make him more amenable. At present he is lying, mechanically and doggedly lying. The roll shows that he has been in the vessel for a year and 4 months. And in any case I yearn for the coffee I smell at no great distance. Will you accompany me?"
"Thank you," said Jagiello, "but I have already had my morning draught in the gun-room."
To his surprise, Stephen found Jack already at table, shaved, pink, and eating voraciously.
"Are you not abed yet, for all love?" he cried.
"Oh, I took a cat-nap in Draper's chair," said Jack. "It sets you up amazingly. Have a beefsteak."
"I thank you, Jack, but a cup of coffee and a piece of toast would answer very well for the moment. I mean to go back to the prisoner very soon. I have thought of a means of confounding the stupid creature. But first, let me congratulate you on having refloated the Minnie. A noble feat, upon my word."
"It was the tide that turned the day," said Jack.
"You would hardly credit that a few miserable inches, and it is no more in the Baltic, you know, could have such an effect. But it gave just that trifle of lift at the very moment we needed it. Another half hour, and I should have had to slip and run.
It was nip and tack, I do assure you. But tell me, what news of the French officers? And what news of the young fellow? How does he do?
Stephen shook his head.
He is still in his deep coma, he said, and I fear I may have been too sanguine last night. The mechanical processes function well enough, and the ligature has held, but the spirit is on the wing, perhaps. However, I hope to learn something about his companions directly.
He carried his coffee back to Jagiello, and once again there was a surprise for him. Something had happened during his absence. The young man had the pleased, slightly mad look of an Apollo, a primitive Apollo, who has just made a neat job of Marsyas, whereas the captive was so pale that his lips showed yellow.
"He has told me quite a lot," said Jagiello, as he set a chair for Stephen and put a cushion in it, "and now he is speaking the truth. He really does not know who the French officers were, because they stayed in the cabin all the time. In principle, the ship was bound for Bornholm, but they could easily have put into Grimsholm on the same voyage. Only the Minnie's captain would have known just where he meant to touch. He did see them when they were launching the boat, and he says they were not old. But that proves nothing. A French colonel or even a general might be quite young. As for Grimsholm, he knows there is a private signal, and the last time the Minnie was there it was a Hamburg Jack upside down on the front mast, but it might have changed since then. Only the captain would know, and then he says no one is ever allowed to land. They must stop at a little island near the shore, present their papers at the wharf, and unload by boats. They talk only to the French, who receive their papers. The little island is at the bottom of the bay, and it has a landing place, a wharf. It is the third of such islands. Draw, incest, he said to the Dane.
Stephen took the drawing and considered it.
Come, he said, let us check these statements with the more prudent, responsible members of the Minnie's crew, and allow me to observe, Mr. Jagiello, that a gold piece, decently proffered, will often obtain the best intelligence, and that the prospect of more in the event of success may elicit a flood of information untainted by concealed malignity. What we have here is very well, very specious, but believe me, I should not move an inch upon it without confirmation.
Jack was still eating, but slowly now, when Stephen returned to the cabin. He had appeared briefly on deck when the loading of the prize was completed, had observed that the wind was steady in the west-northwest, and had given orders that her own people, with a competent guard of marines, should sail the Minnie under the lee of the Ariel and her guns to give his own men a rest. He had also fixed the Ariel's position. If the transports were true to their rendezvous, they should show to the northwest in about an hour, and 2 hours after that Grimsholm should rise in the southeast.
"I have ascertained these facts," said Stephen, rehearsing them and showing the drawing. "They are corroborated by the Minnie's carpenter and boatswain, questioned separately. I do not count her second mate, for he has found means to be drunk, weeping drunk."
"It is very good as far as it goes," said Jack, "but I am not happy about the private signal. The Minnie has not been here for months, and it is very likely to have been changed."
"I abound in your sense, brother," said Stephen, "and I have been thinking about Artemisia."
"Indeed," said Jack.
"Do not suppose I refer to Morselis's wife," said Stephen, raising one finger.
"If you mean the frigate, she is in the West Indies."
"For it is Ligdamse's daughter that I have in mind, the Queen of Kos. As you will recall, she accompanied Xerxes with 5 ships, and she took part in the Battle of Salamis. Perceiving that the day was lost, and that several Athenians were in pursuit of her, she at once attacked a Persian ship. The Athenians assumed that she was an ally, gave over their pursuit, and so allowed her to escape. Now it occurs to me that there is a certain analogy here. Suppose the Minnie were to fly into Grimsholm, all sails abroad, pursued by the Ariel, firing guns. Do you not think it would take? Do not you think that any error in the private signal would be overlooked in such a case, particularly as the Hamburg Jack was valid at the time of the Minnie's last visit?"
Jack thought for a while.
"Yes, I think it would," he said. "But it would have to be convincing. You tell me that a good many of the people on the island are seamen. It would have to be damned well done to convince a seaman. Still, I think it could be managed. Yes, I certainly think it could be managed. I like your scheme, Stephen."
"I am heartily glad you approve it. and since you do, I shall offer some further observations. It would be the pity of the world if the Dutch and Baltic hands Sir James was so kind as to give us were to betray the stratagem by the propriety of their conduct or the uniformity of their dress. They are neat, well-behaved men, accustomed to the discipline of the Royal Navy, and I see that they all wear much the same kind of purses, slops. I suggest they should exchange clothes as well as places with the minis, for what could be more authentic than the Danish garb itself taken from a Danish bag? And then, so that there should be at least some familiar faces aboard, I suggest that her cook and carpenter should remain. They have both accepted a douceur in exchange for information, and they both stand to gain a considerable sum if all goes well.
"It shall be as you say," said Jack, draining the coffee-pot. "I will put it in hand at once."
He went on deck, and shortly afterward the minis began to come aboard in batches. When first they were told to strip, they looked very blank and apprehensive. And even when they were made to understand that this was an exchange, even when they were dressed again in the Ariel's slops, they remained exceedingly suspicious. Back in his cabin, with the ship's books before him, Jack was studying the record of his new hands when Hyde came in.
"I beg your pardon, sir," said he, "but the men say the Danes are lousy, and beg to be excused from putting on their clothes."
"They will be complaining of the weevils next," said Jack.
"I made that point, sir. But Wittgenstein, who speaks for them, said weevils were natural, whereas lice were not, being one of the plagues of Egypt and therefore irreligious. They are afraid for their slops and hammocks, but very much more for their hair. They are extremely unwilling to have to cut off their pigtails, sir, and although they spoke respectfully, I believe they take it very much to heart."
"Let them be called aft, Mr. Hyde," said Jack.
And Stephen observed, "They do not distinguish between pediculus vestimenti, the body allows, and pediculus capitis, which infests the hair. Their pigtails are in no danger at this stage if they do not put on Danish hats." The hands came aft, the men condemned to wear the lousy clothes looking grim and deeply displeased, the others amused and facetious. Jack took their mood at once and said,
"Ben, I understand you don't like lice. Well, I don't like 'em neither. But this is an urgent business we have in hand. There is no time to ship, wash tubs, and boil everything, and to get into Grimsholm you have to look like sloppy joes, not like man-of-war's men. I'm sorry for it, but there is nothing I can do. It is all in the line of duty. And you need not fear for your hair, so long as you do not put on their hats. A very learned gentleman has told me that these are innocent lice. They only go for your body, never for your pigtails. There is pediculo vestimento, and there is pediculo capito. Two quite different kettles of fish, vestments and caps. It is all in the line of duty, as I say, but it comes under the article of hard lying, and each man shall have 1 and 4 pence a day extra. What is more, the prisoners have been given new slops, and they will not lie in your hammocks, but berth in the hold on straw. You cannot ask fairer than that."
He knew he had satisfied them. Pediculo capito had turned the scale before ever he came to the hard-lying money.
"Dismiss the hands, Mr. Hyde," he said, "and let us carry on."
In the cabin once more, he said,
"I intend putting Wittgenstein in charge of the mini to take her in, together with Klopstock and Haas as his mates. I do not contemplate sending any officers."
"Oh, sir," said Hyde, in a tone of deep distress. "I had hoped—"
"I know," said Jack, who understood his feelings perfectly. "But this is a special case. Her crew must look like common Baltic sailors, and our hands can wear what they please without infringing the rules of war. If they are taken, they are ordinary prisoners. If an officer is taken disguised, he is shot as a spy."
"Yes, sir, but I could be in my shirt sleeves with my uniform coat stowed away and my commission in its pocket. Sir, you know how hard promotion is to come by nowadays. A man has to jump into the mouth of a cannon and crawl out by the touch-hole, as they say. And even then he is not always noticed."
Jack hesitated. What Hyde said was perfectly true, and there was a moral obligation on a captain to give his officers their chance, usually in order of seniority. But in addition to the perfectly valid point about uniform, there was another he did not choose to mention. Hyde was a decent, conscientious young fellow, and very good at the shipkeeping side of his task, but he was no great seaman. His one idea of increasing speed was to pack on more sail, whether it pressed the ship down or not. He put her about in a poking, hesitant fashion, and once his unfortunate confusion of right and left had caused the Ariel to miss stays.
If he had been sending an officer at all, Jack would have been far happier with Fenton, a natural-born sailor, but that would be seen as a direct slight. His hesitation did not last long. The issue was clear. No fine feelings must put the Enterprise and Stephen's life in hazard.
"I am sorry, Hyde," he said, "but you must look upon this as being in the line of duty, like the lice. I am sure you will have some other chance of distinguishing yourself presently."
He was not sure of it at all. He felt that his words carried neither conviction nor comfort, and he was glad when four sail of ships were reported on the starboard beam. They were far away, just topsails up, but their course was converging with the aerials, and until they could be certainly identified, he called Wittgenstein and his mates below, solid, middle-aged men with close on 100 years of service between them. He explained that they were to take the Minnie into Grimsholm, making all possible sail from the pursuing aerial. They were to wear a Hamburg jack and Danish colours. They were to anchor off this island, showing them the drawing, and then put Dr. Maturin ashore. Dr. Maturin was to do all the talking, and they were to obey his orders to the letter. They were to speak no English in hearing of the island. They listened attentively, and he was particularly pleased to see how quickly and intelligently they took the point about sailing and behaving like merchant seamen. He was about to go over all these points a third time when Wittgenstein said a little testily,
"Yes, sir, I understand. I ain't no lubber. And by your good leave, I think we ought to go aboard now, promiscuous, to see how she handles."
Jack saw them pull across with their chosen band in their lousy coats, and he saw how quickly they threw off years of discipline, lounging about the deck, talking, leaning on the rail, chewing their quids and spitting, scratching themselves, hanging up their clothes here and there. The Minnie had never been what the Navy would have called a neat ship. Now she looked thoroughly low. By this time, the aerial and the four ships in the northwest had exchanged numbers. As Jack had supposed, they were the transports escorted by Aeolus.
"It is damnably like counting your chickens," he thought,
looking at the troop carriers far over the water, and then southward towards the point where Grimsholm should heave up in time.
"I hope to God it may not bring ill luck."
7 bells in the forenoon watch had struck some while ago, and the sand in the half-hour-glass had nearly run its course. In spite of the general sense of impending crisis, for all hands knew very well what the aerial was about, the ship was filled with the liveliest anticipation of dinner. Yet their usual cheerfulness at this hour was somewhat dampened by the knowledge that they were carrying a corpse. That unlucky thing. The young Frenchman had lost the number of his mess, and the sailmaker had been sent for to sew him into a hammock with 2 round shot at his feet. The officers took their noonday observation with particular care, a good observation that showed Grimsholm somewhat nearer than dead reckoning would have it. The glass was turned, the bell struck, and the hands were piped to their longed-for meal. By the time it was finished, the island would have nicked the clear sky. Shortly after that, Stephen would go aboard the Minnie, and the apparent chase would begin.
"Would it be improper to suggest our dining now?" he asked.
"Not at all," said Jack. "I will give the word at once."
He bent to the cabin skylight and hailed the astonished steward.
"Dinner on the table in 7 minutes. Caviar and the Swedish bread. Omelettes, beefsteaks, the ham, and what is left of the cold goose pie. And rouse out a bottle of champagne and 2 of the burgundy with the yellow seal."
In 7 minutes they sat down, Jack having given orders that he should be told as soon as Grimsholm came in sight.
"I have never eaten enough caviar," said Stephen, helping himself again. "Where did it come from?"
"The Tsar sent it to Sir James, and he passed a barrel on to us. Rum stuff. I dare say it was caviar to the Admiral, too."
This was his only small attempt at wit throughout the meal, and a little caviar was almost all he ate. His stomach was closed, and he could not even drink with relish. Stephen, on the other hand, downed his omelette and 1 pound of steak, finished the cold goose pie, and cut a slice of ham in what would ordinarily have been a very festive way for him. But the feast was no feast. The atmosphere was entirely wrong. They were polite to one another, and there was almost no real contact. It was as though Stephen were already gone, removed to another plane. It was only when they were drinking their port, and Stephen said how he wished they might have some music, In former voyages together they had played innumerable cello and violin duets, often in trying circumstances, that their old relationship came back to life.
"We might try a glee," said Jack with a poor smile.
But at that point a midshipman came to say, with the master's duty, that Grimsholm was sighted from the masthead.
"It is nearly time," said Jack. "We must be chasing long before they see us."
He reached for the decanter, filled their glasses, and raised his, saying,
"Here's my dear love to you, Stephen," and—
The glass dropped from his hand and broke.
"Jesus,"
he said in a low voice, appalled.
"Never mind it, never mind it," said Stephen, mopping his breeches. "Now listen, Jack, will you? There are just three things I must say before I go aboard the Minnie. If I succeed, I shall hoist the Catalan flag. You know the Catalan flag, I am sure."
"I am ashamed to say I do not."
"It is yellow with four bloody stripes down it, and if you see it, when you see it, you must send to the transports, which will obviously be out of sight of the island, to tell them to come in, and you must come in yourself at once, flying the same flag in some place of honourable distinction. I suppose we have one?"
"Oh, the sailmaker will run up half a dozen. Yellow Jack with stripes of the spare pennant."
"Just so. And I beg, Jack, that you will salute the fortress with all the guns proper for such a place, or even more, and that you will receive the commanding officer with the ceremony due to a nobleman."
"If he comes with you, Stephen, he shall have a royal salute."
Stephen crossed the lane of water, and they saw him hauled aboard the Minnie. The aerial signalled to the remote Aeolus to haul her wind, backed her topsails to give the Minnie 2 miles start, and at last the long hours of chase began. Stephen sat on an old kitchen chair by the mizzenmast out of the way. He had a satchel of papers on his lap, and he looked steadily forward at Grimsholm, fine on the larboard bow and growing larger. There was no point in preparing a careful, ordered statement. Everything would depend on the first moments, on the presence or absence of French officers, on his reception, and from that point on it would be an improvisation, a cadenza. He whistled the Montserrat Salva Regina, embroidering the theme. From the aerial's bows, Jack could see him plainly over the clear grey sea, even without his glass, a black figure sitting there. All too plainly. With this fine breeze well abaft the beam, the aerial had been overhauling the Minnie faster than was right this last half hour.
"Let her go and veer away,"
he said, and the spritsail course, its clews stopped, dropped into the sea over her blind quarter, acting as a drogue. It checked her speed, but not too obviously. She still gained a little, and 10 minutes later he said to the gunner,
"Very well, Mr. Nuttall, I think we may open fire. You know what to do. Take great care, Mr. Nuttall."
"Never you fear, sir," said the gunner. "I filled all our rotten old white grain. She's in no danger."
He fired. The ball pitched 200 yards short and 50 yards wide. The Minnie responded with a fatigallant weather stunsel.
"It must look right, though," said Jack.
"Never you fear, sir," said the gunner again. "Just you wait till the gun warms up."
The gun warmed up. The guns, indeed, for the aerial kept giving a slight yaw to bring first one chaser, then the other into action, increasing her rate of fire, but diminishing her speed. The carefully chosen round shot cut up the water so close to the Minnie that once or twice the spray came aboard her. It was pretty practice, but it did not give the more experienced seamen in the aerial as much satisfaction as the sailing of the ship, the perpetual slight rising of sheets, the overpress of somewhat unbalanced sails, all the 100 capers her captain had learnt in the oceans of the world, everything to give the impression of great eagerness and of the utmost haste, without in fact gaining very much. The stroke that gave most pleasure was his order to set the main royal, a risky sail in such a breeze even with sound spars.
"You are forgetting, sir," said Mr. Hyde, "the mast is sprung."
"I have that in mind, Mr. Hyde," said Jack. "A way aloft."
Mast, sail, and yard carried away after the first minute, a most spectacular sight from the land. And all the while Grimsholm came nearer, with the whole broad range of mainland shore that it guarded, miles of shoal-free coast with perfect landing places for an army, quite apart from the river port of Schweinau. For some time now the higher batteries had been in view, with the smoke wafting from their hot-shot furnaces, and in the transparent evening air good eyes could make out the red of the tricolour at the flagstaff. Nearer still lay the ill-defined limit of the battery's range of accurate fire. Wittgenstein evidently thought he was close to it, for he had already broken out the Hamburg Jack. If the ruse had taken, if the watchers on that hill had been deceived, the Minnie would pass the invisible frontier unharmed. If not, she would probably be damaged, possibly sunk. In his telescope, Jack could see the artillerymen busy about their batteries, and the smoke from the furnaces had increased.
"Surely to God they can reach this far,"
he said to himself, standing there on the forecastle with his hands clasped behind his back.
42-pounders, and with all that height!
Closer, closer still. And at last the long-expected flashes, the jetting smoke and then the roar, deeper than the guns of any ship.
"Cast off the drag sail! Stand by the starboard guns!" he cried,
and as he spoke the shot pitched, well grouped, and in a deadly true line, a cable's length beyond the aerial.
"Beyond the aerial, by God! Hard aweather!" he cried. "Fire as they bear!"
The aerial turned on her heel so fast that the broadside went off as one gun. It should have been a harmless discharge for carronades at this range, but one freakish ricochet went home, piercing the Minnie's mizzen topsail. Jack had not time to notice that, however. He was wholly taken up with manoeuvring his ship out of the shocking fire that opened upon her. They had lured him in, well within the limit, and now the seas spurted white on either hand. Had he not had a fine brisk breeze and a handy crew, he must have been severely mauled, if not sunk, by the tons of red-hot iron they flung at him with such appalling accuracy. As it was, his sails were much tattered. A fire had started in the starboard head. One cutter had been destroyed, and the fatigant mast wounded before he ran out of range. When he was quite sure that the upper batteries were not playing fox, but were in fact unable to reach him, he brought the aerial to the wind, told Hyde to set about knotting and splicing and bending new sails, and ran up to the maintop. From here he could see the whole bay perfectly well, the small islands at the bottom of it, the officers' houses and the barracks beyond, and halfway down the bay between the two flanking batteries, the Minnie, slowly taking in her t'gallants as she glided towards the landing place. A long, long pause while the work of the ship went on all round him, and the Minnie crept on. At last she rounded to and dropped her anchor some way from the shore. They seemed to be hoisting out a boat, but the declining sun sent such long shadows that he could scarcely make it out.
"On deck there!" he called. "Send up a telescope!"
Hyde brought it up himself.
"I can see them, sir," he said, "just to the right, to the left, of the large red house on shore."
Jack made no reply. He was hardly aware of the man's presence. There was Stephen, sharply focused in his glass, looking pale, but no paler than usual, sitting in the stern sheets while Wittgenstein pulled him towards a low jetty full of men drawn up in formal ranks that dissolved as Jack watched, leaving him in a state of the utmost doubt. He could not tell what it signified. In the boat itself Stephen sat quiet. The first signs had been favourable. The Minnie had not been fired upon. A voice from one of the flanking batteries, as they sailed close in, had called out to know whether they had brought any tobacco, and the Danish cook's reply had brought a roar of satisfaction. But these were only preliminaries. The real test lay 100 yards ahead, where those soldiers were waiting under arms. He had been weak enough to let himself be influenced by Jack's dismay at the childish omen, and by the young man's death. And although this was in some ways the easiest of his important missions, he had a premonition of disaster. He wondered at it, and at his own attachment to life. There were so many exquisite things in it. The smell of the clean sea, the golden light of the westering sun, to say nothing of an eagle soaring on the wind. His strength was not as great as he had supposed. These contradictions, this conflict between theory and practice, were turning in his mind when his whole spirit was jerked into the immediate present by the sight of the ordered ranks on the jetty dissolving into an ordinary crowd, no more. It had been a guard of honour. At the sight of a mere black coat coming ashore, it had been dismissed. Its function was to honour superior officers, not civilians. Wittgenstein spun the little boat about and made a sternboard so that it bumped against the jetty. Stephen stood up, hesitated, leapt for a bollard with a sergeant standing by it and missed his hold. He fell between the jetty and the boat, and coming to the surface, called out in Catalan, "Pull me out, Helen Death!"
"Art a Catalan?" cried the sergeant, amazed.
"Mother of God, of course I am," said Stephen. "Pull me out."
"I am amazed," said the sergeant, staring.
But two corporals next to him flung down their muskets, leaned over, took Stephen's hands, and drew him up.
"Thank you, friends," said he, above a whole crowd of voices that wanted to know where he came from, what he was doing here, what news of Barcelona, Lleida, Palamos, Ripoll, what the ship had brought, and was there any wine. "Now tell me, where is Colonel Dullestrett?"
"He wants the colonel," said some.
Others said,
"Can't he see him?"
And the crowd parted, pointing. Stephen saw a small, upright, familiar figure.
"Padre!" he cried.
"Esteve!"
cried his godfather, raising his arms, and they ran together and embraced, patting one another on the back in the Catalan manner. This Jack saw among the lengthening shadows as the sun dipped over Sweden, but he could not make it out clearly for the crowd. Was it a greeting? Was it an arrest? A savage conflict? Nor could he tell what it meant when the whole group moved off to the large house painted red, though he stared until the red faded and the whole bay was filled with darkness, pricked with lights here and there in the old glow of the furnaces. The aerial stood on and off all night. He slept, or at least he lay down until the middle watch, the dead hours of the night, when he climbed slowly into the dew-soaked top and sat there wrapped in his cloak, watching the stars and the lights of Aeolus and her transports that had orders to close within signalling distance after sunset. He was there still at the changing of the watch, when the master came on deck and Fenton said,
"There you have her. Topsails and jib, course northeast by east, a half east, one glass, southwest by west, a half west, the other glass. Captain to be called if anything happens. Any lights or activity on shore?"
Then, in a lower voice,
"He's in the main top."
He was still there at the break of dawn, and as the light slowly mounted in the sky, he wiped the dew from his objective glass. He trained it first on the empty flagstaff, and then at the end of the bay. They had already cleared all the deck cargo off the Minnie, but that proved nothing. Soldiers were already moving about, and he heard a trumpet, high and clear, sounding a call he did not know. Gradually the red house resumed its colour, and presently he saw movement there, but too dim and far for any real distinction. Two bells, and they began to clean the decks below him. Up to the flagstaff again for the 20th time, and this time there was a group of men at its foot. He saw the rolled colours run up, a small black ball, hesitate at the top and break out, streaming bravely southwards. Yellow, with four red strips. Joy filled his thumping heart, and he fixed it while he might have counted 10 to make certainty doubly sure. And as he looked, he saw the little group of men throw up their hats, join hands and dance in a ring. He thought he made out cheering from the shore. Then, leaning over the rim, he called,
"Mr. Grimmond, take her into the bay."
He was so stiff that he went down through the lubber's hole, chuckling to himself as he did so.
"Lord, what a fat ass I've become."
On the quarter-deck he gave orders for the signal that should bring the transports in, for the Catalan flags that should adorn the aerial's mastheads, and for the coffee and Swedish bread that should still the grinding of his famished stomach.
"Mr. Hyde," he said, "I should like the ship to look particularly well today, if you please, fit to receive a nobleman."
He stood there, eating and drinking on a cleaned, dried patch of deck as the aerial repassed the dreaded limit of the great gun's reach, and he noticed that the officers looked uncommonly alert and grave, staring up at the great batteries.
"Pass the word for the gunner," he said after a while. "Mr. Nuttall, we will salute the fortress with 21 guns when I give the word."
He waited. Waited until the aerial was right between the two deadly flanking batteries far within the bay, and then said,
"Carry on with the salute."
Crisp and clear, at precise intervals it came, and the moment the 21st gun had spoken, the rocks on either hand, all the great casemates rising one above another overhead, vanished in a swirling cloud of smoke that dimmed the sky, and an enormity of sound, a universal roar.
a cloud perpetually renewed, perpetually stabbed with flashes from every gun in Grimsholm, so that to the watching transports the whole island seemed to be in eruption, and this in a volume of sound so prodigiously great that the air, the sea, and the aerial trembled, and all her people stood motionless, stunned, amazed, deafened, until the last echoes rolled away, and they slowly realized that this was the returning of their salute, their peaceful welcome.